Proyas had been there. He had clenched his teeth in shame, squinted through tears of heartbreak, watching the portly sorcerer condemn the first true prophet in 1,000 years, condemn the holy Aspect Emperor as false. Only to be told now, on the very threshold of apocalypse, that he had spoken true? Yes, Kellis said, watching him with unnerving concentration. So even now you're manipulating me? The exalt general could scarce believe he had asked the question. There is no other way for me to be with you, the Aspect Emperor replied. I see what you do not. The origins of your thought and passion, the terminus of your fear and ambit. You experience but a fragment of the Nursi Proyas I see. With every word, I speak to you in ways you cannot hear. Some kind of test. It had to be. Kellis was sounding him, preparing him for some kind of trial. But the Aspect Emperor downed his bowl in a single draught. How could that be when you feel free to say, to think any way you please? Yes, I never feel so free as I feel when I am with you. In all the world, wherever I go, Kellis, I sense the jealousies and judgments of others. With you, I know I have no cause for weariness or concern. With you, I am my own judge. But that is the only man you know, Lesser Proyas. The man I know, the Greater Proyas, I hold in shackles of iron. I am Dunyain, my friend, exactly as a commune claimed. To merely stand in my presence is to be enslaved. Perhaps this was the golden kernel, the whole point of these thought-bruising sessions. To understand how little he was himself. There was no revelation without terror and overturning. But I am your willing slave. I choose a life of bondage. And he felt no shame in saying this. Ever since childhood he had understood the exaltation that was submission. To be a slave to truth is to be a master of men. The Aspect Emperor leaned back into the glow of his unearthly halo. As always, the hearth's twirling light stretched smoky glimpses of doom across the canvas walls behind him. For a heartbeat, the exalt general could swear he saw children running. Choice, his lord and god said, smiling. Willing. Your shackles are cast from this very iron. Sorweel and Zaranga sat unceremoniously in the dust at the entrance of the tent they now shared, gnawing on their ration of amicut. Gone was the successor prince's garish pavilion. Gone were the ritual wigs. Gone were the sumptuous cushions, the ornate decorations. Gone were the slaves who had borne all this pointless luxury. Necessity, as Protathus famously wrote, makes jewels of lack and turns poverty into gold. For the men of the ordeal, wealth was now measured in absence of burdens. They sat side by side, gazing with a kind of numb incredulity, as the figure wobbled toward them through the haze of knee-high dust. They recognized him immediately, though it did not seem so at the time, so quick is the heart to deny what it cannot bear. Limbs like black ropes, hair white as the sky. He staggered as much as he walked. A gait that spoke of endless miles, 1,000 steps too many. Only his gaze remained steady, as if all that remained of him had been concentrated into his sense of sight. He did not blink once the entirety of his approach. Swaying, he stood before them. "You are supposed to be dead," Zaranga said, looking up with a peculiar terror, his voice wavering about some contest of dismay and gratitude.
"I am told,"
Obategua rasped, his smile more a lipless grimace.
"My death is your duty."
Sorweel made to leave, but the successor prince cried out for him to stay. "I beg you," he said. "Please." So he helped the old man into the tent, shocked, nauseated even, by his kindling weight. He watched his friend chew his food, then offer up the resulting paste. He watched him raise Obategua's feet so that he might wash them, only to wash his shins instead because of the ulcerations that cankered his toes and heel. He listened to him whisper to the ailing servant in the warm, resonant tones of their native language. He understood none of it, and yet grasped all of it, for the tones of love and gratitude and remorse transcend all languages, even those from different ends of the world. So we watched Obatego blink two tears, as if they were all that remained, and somehow he just knew. The man had lived so long only to obtain permission to die. With fingers of trembling teak, the obligate reached beneath his tunic and withdrew a small golden cylinder, which Saranga clasped with solemn disbelief. He watched his friend take a knife to the old man's wrists. He watched the lantern oil of his life leak into the earth, until the guttering flame that was Obatego shined no more. He stared at the inanimate body, wondered that it could seem as dry as the earth. Saranga cried out, as if freed of some long-suffering obligation to remain strong. He wept with outrage and shame and sorrow. Sorweel embraced him, felt the anguish kick through his powerful frame. Afterward, when the night had drawn its chill shroud over the world beyond their tent, Saranga told a story about how, in his eighth summer, he had come for no reason he could fathom to covet his older cousin's battle sash. So much so, he actually crept into his quarters and stole it. "Things glitter in the eyes of a child," he said, speaking with the blank manner of the bereaved. "They shine more than is seemly." Thinking himself clever, he had taken care to hide the thing in Obatego's annex to his room, in his matin satchel. Of course, giving the ceremonial importance of the sash, a hue and cry was raised the instant it was discovered missing. By some stroke of disastrous fortune, it was found among Obatego's effects shortly after, and the obligate was seized. "Of course they knew I was the culprit," Saranga explained, staring down at his thieving palms. "This is an old trick among my people, a way to peel past the bark, as they say. Someone else is accused of your crime, and unless you confess, you're forced to witness their punishment." Seized by the terror and shame that so often makes puppets of children, Saranga had said nothing. Even as Obatego was whipped, he said nothing. And to his everlasting shame, the obligate said nothing as well. Imagine the whole of the inner court watching him be whipped and knowing full well that I was the one. So he did what most children do when cornered by some fact of failure or weakness. He made believe. He told himself that Obatego had stolen the sash, out of spite, out of fascination. Who knew what moved lesser souls? "I was a child," Saranga cried, his voice pinched 8 summers short. One day passed, 2, 3, and still he said nothing. The whole world seemed bent to the warp of his fear. His father ceased speaking to him. His mother continually blinked tears. And so the farce continued. At some level he knew that the world knew, but the stubbornness would not relent. Only Obatego treated him precisely as before. Only Obatego, the one bearing his welts, played along. Then his father summoned him and Obatego to his apartments. The Satakan was furious, to the point of kicking over braziers and spilling fiery coals across the floor. But Obatego, true to his character, remained amiable and calm. "He assured father that I felt shame," the successor prince recalled with a vacant stare. "He bid him recall my eyes and take heart in the pain he had seen there. Given this," he said, "my silence should be cause for pride, for it is the curse of rulers to bear the burden of shameful secrets." "Only weak rulers confess weakness," he said. "Only wise rulers bear the full burden of their crimes. Take heart knowing your son is both strong and wise." Saranga hung upon these words for a time. He glanced at the shadowy corpse at their feet, sat blinking at the impossibility. And Sorweel knew precisely what he felt, the way you lose so much more than simply another voice and gaze from an otherwise crowded life. He knew that many things in Saranga's life had some history, peculiar to him and Obatego alone, that they had shared a world between them, a world that was gone. "And what do you think?" Sorweel dared ask. "That I was foolish and weak," Saranga said. They spoke of Obatego long into the night, and it seemed indistinguishable from speaking about life. They said things wise and foolish by turns, as young, intelligent men are prone. At last, when weariness and grief overcame them, Zaranga told the Sekarpai king how Obatego had insisted that he befriend Sorweel, how the old obligate had always believed that he would surprise them all. And then the successor prince told him how, on the morn, he would add the name Harweel to his ancestor list.
"A brother," the successor prince whispered with startling violence. "Sekarpus has a brother in Zaum."
They slept with the beloved dead, as was the custom in High Holy Zaum. Their breathing pulled deep with the rhythmic life, a garland about the breathless. They awoke before the interval, buried Obatego without marker on the gray, desolate plain. Sorweel and Zaranga hung about the edges of the general's retinue, witless for the lack of sleep and the expenditure of passion. The sun had climbed past the precincts of noon, drawing the shadows of things to the east. The line of the land, which for so long reached out in a monotonous crescent before them, had been broken and multiplied. Low knolls rose against low ridges. Ravines rutted mounded distances. Gravel spilled from wandering defilades. The army of the Middle North mobbed the horizon immediately behind them, its innumerable pennants little more than shadows lulling through the steaming dust. They rode as they always did at this time of day, their brows angled away from the sun's glare, their thoughts wandering on the slack leash of midday boredom. Sorweel was the first to glimpse the speck hanging low over the western horizon. He had fallen into the habit of reading the world as much as watching it, so he said nothing, convinced he witnessed some kind of sign. Was it another stork come to communicate the inexplicable? He was quickly disabused of this conceit. The speck, whatever it was, hung in the faraway air more like a bumblebee than a bird, like something too cumbersome to fly. He peered, squinted as much out of disbelief as against the high sun. He saw black horses, a team of four. He saw wheels. A chariot, he realized, a flying chariot. For a time he simply watched stupefied, rocking in rhythm to his mount's dogged trot. A chorus of alarms cracked the air. The general's Polarian escort leapt into formation about their flanks, their armor and tunics shining green and gold. The nuns who accompanied Serwa cried out in arcane unison, lit out their billows as they strode glimmering into the sky. The sorceress chariot rode a low arc over the churned landscape. Sunlight flashed across panels laden with graven images. Sorweel saw three pale faces swaying above the gilded rail, one of them shouting light. Cayudas, for his part, betrayed no surprise or urgency whatsoever. "Silence!" he cried to those in his immediate circle. "Decorum!" Then, without a word of explanation, he tore off, galloping on a long plume of dust. The witches hung motionless in the air, their billows winding and waving about them. The retinue, which typically rode in a loose mass, flattened into a crescent as the officers and caste nobles jostled for vantages. Sorweel and Zaranga watched from the center of the press. The sky chariot banked toward the Prince Imperial and swung to earth. The hooves of the blacks bit hard into the denuded turf, and wings of dust and gravel sprawled about their glossy flanks. Golden wheels gleamed about spokes spun into invisibility. The center figure leaned back, pulling hard on the reins. Standing in his stirrups, Cayudas raced out to meet them, hailed them with a raised arm. The three strangers turned toward him in unison. "They're not human," Zaranga said. His tone was ragged, and not for exhaustion. He sounded like a man who had had his fill of miraculous things, like a man straining to believe. The Kidrahil general reined his pony into a dusty halt, exchanged what seemed cryptic greetings. Nothing could be heard on the arid wind. Then, with scarce a breath expended, he wheeled his mount about and began trotting back toward his astonished command. The sky chariot lurched into motion behind him, trundling across the earth. And for some reason, Of all the awe-inspiring sights Sorweel had seen and would see, none would be so arresting as the sight of the gilded chariot wheeling back into the open sky. He understood his friend's beseeching tone, for it had made a beehive of his own breast as well. Non-men. So many miracles, all of them speaking for his enemy's cause. For reasons he could scarce fathom, the exalt general found himself pondering the siege and fall of Shaima, the final night of the First Holy War, as he walked the short distance from his pavilion to the black silhouette of the umbilicus. Fleeing the streets of the holy city, he had climbed onto the pediment of an ancient fullery, where he had watched his holy aspect emperor battle the last of the heathen Kisharim. There had been five of them, primaries, mightier, despite the crudity of their art, than the most accomplished schoolmen. Five hellish figures floating high above the burning city, their eyes gouged that they might see the water that was light. And Anacerimber Kellis had slain them all. Such was the power of the man he had come to worship. Such was the might. So how had his soul let slip the ardor of his faith? Why had hope, an inflexible determination, become foreboding and gnawing worry? The men of the ordeal hailed him, as they always did when he walked the interior ways of the camp, but for once he did not return their salutations. He fairly knocked over Lord Currus Nantilla, the general of the Kengemi, at the entryway to the umbilicus. Such was the depth of his walking reverie. He squeezed the man's shoulder in lieu of an apology. At long last the plains had yielded. At long last the great ordeal, the sum of his lifelong hope and toil, trod the fabled lands named in the holy sagas. At long last they marched into the shadow of foul Golgotharath. Golgotharath! For all the perils facing them, for all the privations, this should be a time of jubilation. For who in all the world could withstand the might of Anacerimber Kellis? No one. Not even the dread consort of Mog Farrow. So why did his heart pound air into his veins? He resolved to make this his question. He resolved to set aside his pride, and to reveal the full extent of his misgivings. To ask his prophet how he could doubt his prophet. But for once the aspect emperor was not alone in his chamber. He stood arms out while two body-slaves attended him, cinching and fussing robes freighted with ceremonial splendor, the costume of a Kedai warrior king from far antiquity. He wore a full-length gown whose hems had been bound into his ankle wraps, golden vambraces encased his forearms, and matching greaves his shins. Opposing Kyrenian lions gleamed across his breastplate. With his statue and haloed mien, he seemed a vision from some ancient relief, save for the two severed demon heads hanging from his girdle. "You are troubled, I know," Kellis said, grinning at his exalt general. "For all your yearning, for all your faith, yours remains a pragmatic soul, Proius." The slaves continued a silent labor, binding straps and laces. The aspect emperor glanced down at his garb, rolled his eyes as if offering himself up as a poor example. "You have little patience for tools you cannot immediately use." As a young child, one of Proius's duties had been to bear his mother's train at public ceremonies. All he remembered of the toddling farce was stumbling after the long, dragging hems, clutching embroidery, losing it, then stumbling after the hems again, while all the Kenryan court roared in adoring laughter around him. In so many ways, Kellis made him feel the same tender fool, always chasing, always stumbling. "If I have failed—" Kellis interrupted him with a warm hand on his shoulder. "Please, Proius, I'm just saying we grapple with earthly things tonight." "Earthly things." A broad smile cracked the flaxen curls of the aspect emperor's mustache and beard. "Yes, the Nonman king has finally answered our call." "Earthly," Proius reflected, was not a term many would accord the ghouls. "Even now his embassy waits here in the umbilicus," his lord and god continued. "We will receive them in the 11 pole chamber. Within a matter of heartbeats, Proyas found himself immersed in the organizational carnival that perpetually characterized life behind the veils of power. Slaves took him in hand, washing his hands, brushing and perfuming his field armor, oiling and combing his hair and beard. A part of him always found it remarkable, the degree of coordination required for even the simplest and most impromptu of state occasions. An imperial eunuch, festooned in insignia from across the three seas, led him out into the airy chill of the 11-pole chamber. Kellis already stood on the low dais, dispensing trivial instructions to a small mob of functionaries. The Ekinu, the sorceress Eris that framed the throne, writhed gold on black with the utter absence of motion. Glimpsing Proyas, Kellis gestured for him to stand at his side. His thoughts racing, the exalt general took his place next to the throne, convinced he could feel the sinuous, symbolic twine of the Ekinu in the air behind him. He had never been able to fathom the significance of the non-men to the ordeal, especially since whatever strength they could muster would be but a fraction of their former glory, and scarcely anything at all compared with the might of the great ordeal, at least in his humble, human opinion. But Kellis had sent hundreds to their death, if not thousands, in his perpetual attempts to contact Nilgikas, small fleets charged with leaving the three seas and running the coasts of Zaum, thence into the mists of the ocean and the legendary shores of Injournias. All in the name of striking an alliance with a 10,000-year-old king. Another question to trouble their discussions. Proyas gazed into the gloom of the tented heights. Only three braziers had been lighted, so they seemed a small island of illumination, surrounded by the half-glimpsed circumfix banners and walls and panels, so dim as to be nothing more than the ghosts of structure. The slaves and functionaries withdrew, taking the air of carnival bustle with them. Save for the shadowy guards posted about the chamber's perimeter, it was just the two of them. "I have pulled aside the harem beads," Kellis said. "And you will find my wives ugly." The exalt general coughed aloud. Such was his consternation.
"What?"
"Your question," Kellis said, chuckling. He spoke in the wry, warm tones of a friend who has always dwelt several paces closer to the peace that truth delivers. "You wonder how it is you can doubt after so many years of witness and miracle?"
I'm not sure I understand."
"There's a reason men prefer their prophets dead, Proyas." Kellis stared askance at his exalt general, one eyebrow hooked in, do you see, curiosity. And Proyas did see. He realized that he had understood all along. His question, he suddenly realized, was no question at all, but instead a complaint. He did not doubt so much as yearn for the simplicity of simple belief. "We begin believing when we are children," Kellis continued. "And so we make childish expectations our rule, the measure for what the holy should be." He gestured to the ornamentation about them, spare as it was compared with the flesh-pots of the South. "Simplicity, symmetry, beauty. These are but the appearance of the holy. The gilding that deceives. What is holy is difficult, ugly beyond comprehension, in the eyes of all save the god." And then the Polarian seneschal announced the visitors. "Remember," Kellis murmured as a mother might, "forgive them their peculiarities." Three striding figures resolved from the gloom, hooded in black cloaks that shone as though slicked in rain. "And beware their beauty." The foremost figure paused immediately below them, threw back his cloak, which slipped into a pool of kneaded folds at the heels of his boots. His scalp gleamed with the pallor of cold mutton fat. His face was alarming, as much for its perfection as for its resemblance to the shrank. He wore a hauberk that was at once a gown, one that baffled the eyes for the wrought delicacy of the chain. Innumerable serpents no larger than the clippings of a child's nails. "I am Nin Sarikas," the nonman answered in high Cuneiric. a language Proyas had spent years mastering so he could read the sagas in their original tongue. "Dispossessed son of Sile, emissary of his most subtle glory, Nilgicus, king of Injonias." His bow fell short of what Janane demanded. "We have ridden long and hard to find you." Kellis regarded him the way he regarded all penitents who found their way to his feet, as someone who had stumbled out of wintry desolation into the warm, sultry glow of summer. "You are surprised," he said in a voice that easily matched the melodious resonance of the Nonman's. "You thought us doomed." A serpentine blink. The preternatural eyes clicked to the Aspect Emperor's right, to the sorceress Aris, Proyas realized. He understood what Kellis had meant by peculiarities. Something about the ghoul's manner followed unexpected lines. For the first time, he noticed that the Nonman stood nude beneath the gleam of his nimble hauberk. "Nilgicus sends his greetings," Nincericus said. "Even in an age so dark, the light that is the Aspect Emperor shines for all to see." A leonine nod. "Then Ishterabinth is with us." The emissary's air of vague distraction lapsed into outright insolence. Rather than answer, Nincericus peered across the 11th pole chamber's airy interior. Then, with the remote reserve of those careful to conceal their disgust, considered Proyas and the Polarian guards flanking him. Weathering the inhuman scrutiny, Proyas suffered a strange twinge of inadequacy, one he imagined caste menials felt in the presence of nobles, a presentiment of bodily and spiritual inferiority. Like the angels of a long-dead god, the Nonmen stood rigid with a pride that had outlived their glory. Only the mien and manner of the Aspect Emperor dwarfed them, a sun to their moon. "The memory of your forefathers' treachery," the emissary finally replied, his gaze lingering on Proyas, "burns bright with us. For some, Anna Sarimber is the very name of mannish arrogance and disorder." At this, several Polarians loosened their broadswords in their scabbard. Proyas was quick in raising his hand to restrain them, knowing the Nonman spoke from the vantage of ages, that for them, generations of men were as fleeting as mice. They had no grave to swallow their ancient grudges. Kellis betrayed no consciousness of the affront. He leaned forward in a familiar way, resting his elbows on his knees, clasped his haloed hands. "Is Ishterabinth with us?" A long, cold gaze. For the first time, Proyas noticed how the two Nonmen accompanying Nincericus held their eyes down as though in ritual shame. "Yes," the emissary said. "The sacred Ishroy of Injonias will add voice and shield to your ordeal if you retake Dagliash, if you honor the Nyam." Proyas had never heard of the Nyam. Dagliash, he knew, was the fortress the ancient High Nosarai had raised to guard against Golgotharath. It stood to reason that the ghouls would want some guarantee of success before casting their lot. "Have you seen the massacre we have wrought?" Kellis cried in the semblance of a more impassioned ruler. "No horde so great has ever been overcome. Not Pirpahal, not Eleniot, no age of man or nonman has seen a host such as the one I have assembled." He stood to peer into the emissary's inhuman face, and somehow the world seemed to lean with him, milky with the roar of intangible things. "The great ordeal will reach Golgotharath." The Exalt General had seen innumerable men, strong, proud men, shrivel beneath the Aspect Emperor's divine scrutiny, so many that it had come to seem a law of nature. But Nincericus remained as remote as before. "If you retake Dagliash, if you honor the Nyam." Proyas took care not to look at his lord and god directly, knowing that the sight of subordinates watching their rulers would be taken as a sign of weakness. But he found himself desperately curious as to the intricacies of Kellis's expression. The art. Proyas had witnessed many men deny the Aspect Emperor through the years, either through him, as was the case with King Harwheel of Sarkarpus, or directly, but never in circumstances so extraordinary. daring souls, and foolish, given that so few yet breathed.
Agreed, the Aspect Emperor said.
A concession? Why did he need these inhuman ghouls?
Once again, Ninsiricus's bow fell short of what Janane demanded. He lifted his aquiline face. His glittering black gaze fell to Kellis's waist, to the abominations hanging from his hip.
"We are curious," the non-man said. "The kifrang bound about your girdle. Is it true you have walked the outside and returned?"
Kellis resumed his seat, leaned back with a single foot extended.
"Yes."
An almost imperceptible nod.
"And what did you find?"
Kellis propped his face with his right hand, two fingers pressed to his temple.
"You worry that I never truly returned," he said mildly.
"That the soul of Anasarimber Kellis writhes in some hell, and a demon kifrang gazes upon you instead."
The decapitants, as the demonic heads have come to be called, was something willfully ignored by many among the Zordunyani. A kind of indigestible proof. Proyas was one of the few who knew something about their acquisition, how Kellis, during one of the longer truces that punctuated the Unification Wars, spent several weeks studying with Heramari Iokas, the Grand Master of the Scarlet Spires, learning the darkest ways of anagogic sorcery. The Deimos. Proyas had been among the first to see them when they returned from Carathuzel, and perhaps the first to dare ask Kellis what had happened. His reply loomed large among the many unforgettable things the man had told him over the years. "There are two species of revelation, my old friend. Those that seize, and those that are seized. The first are the province of the priest. The latter belong to the sorcerer."
After so many years, his skin still prickled in revulsion when he glimpsed the decapitants. But unlike many of the faithful, Proyas never forgot that the prophet was also a mage, a shaman, not unlike those piously condemned by the Tusk. He was the new covenant, the sweeping away of all the old measures. So many former sins had become new virtues. Women had claimed the privileges of men. Sorcerers had become priests. Obscenity should hang from the waist of salvation, or so it had come to seem.
"Such thefts," Ninsiricus said with passionless tact, "such substitutions, they have happened before."
"Why should you care?" Kellis said.
"If your hatred is satisfied, your ancient foe at last destroyed? Ever have men been ruled by tyrants? Why should you care what soul lies behind our cruelty?"
A single inhuman blink.
"May I touch you?"
"Yes." The emissary instantly stepped forward, sparking cries and the bearing of weapons throughout the gloom.
"Leave him," Kellis said. Ninsiricus had paused immediately above the Aspect Emperor, the hem of his chain gown swaying. For the first time he betrayed something resembling indecision, and Proyas realized the creature was, in his own inhuman manner, terrified. The exalt general almost smiled, such was his gratification. The emissary extended a sallow hand, which the Aspect Emperor clasped in a firm, human grip. For a heartbeat, it seemed that worlds, let alone the shadowy confines of the 11-pole chamber, dangled from their grasp.
Sun and moon. Man and non-man.
The clasp broke with the gliding of fingers.
"What did you see?" Ninsiricus asked, with what seemed genuine curiosity. "What did you find?"
"God, broken into a million warring splinters."
A grim nod.
"We worship the spaces between the gods."
"Which is why you are damned."
Another nod, this one strangely brittle.
"As false men."
The Aspect Emperor nodded in stoic regret.
"As false men."
The emissary retreated from the dais, resumed his place at the fore of his voiceless companions.
"And why should the false men lend their strength to the true?"
"Because of Hanalinku," the Holy Aspect Emperor of the Three Seas declared. "Because of Kujara Kimwa. Because 4,000 years ago all your wives and daughters were murdered, and you were cursed to go mad in the shadow of that memory, to live forever, dying their deaths."
Nincericus bowed yet again, this time deeper, yet still far short of honoring Jinane.
"If you retake Dagliash," he said, "if you honor the Nyam."
As he had every morning since the Battle of the Horde, Sorweel awoke before the interval's toll. He lay aching in his cot, more pinched than worn by his woolen blanket, blinking at the impossibility of his straits. Other than a residue of warmth that made cold dismay of his every waking, nothing sensible remained of his dreams. He knew only that he dreamed of better places. He could only dream of better places. Saranga lay on his side as he always did, one arm thrown askew, his face the image of boyish bliss. Sorweel regarded him for a bleary moment, thinking as he often thought that the man's future wives would love him best like this, in the innocence of his mornings. The young king crept from his cot, fumbled with his gear in the dawning pallor, and slipped outside so as to not disturb his brother from Zeum. He savored the chill of breathing open sky, rubbed his bearding chin as he gazed out across the encampment. He felt the clamor to come, the rousing of thousands about him, and the warring of doubts within. Another day marching with the great ordeal. The discomfort of long watches in the saddle, the ligatures of sweat, the ache of perpetual squinting, the anxiousness of the accumulating hoard. And for a fleeting moment, he knew the peace of those first to awaken, the gratitude that accompanies solitary lulls. He sat on his rump to labor with his riding boots.
"Truth shines,"
a voice chimed.
"Truth shines," habit replied for him. Anasarimba Sirwa stood before him, her silken billows knotted tight about her slight form. She had appeared without the merest inkling. From his first glimpse, Sorweel knew he would crouch peering after her departure, looking for her footfalls across the trampled dust. She stood to his left, beneath the arch of the bluing sky. Crimson gilded the edges of the tents jumbled behind her. She drew back a lick of flaxen hair from her cheek.
"The charioteer you and my brother found. Father has met with them."
"The embassy," Sorweel said, squinting up at her. "Kayuda said your father hopes to forge a treaty with Ishterabinth."
She smiled.
"You know of Ishterabinth in Sarkarpus?"
He scowled and shrugged.
"From the sagas. None thought it real. The mightiest among the Kuya dwelled there still."
He did not know what to say, so he turned back to his boots. He never felt the goddess so fiercely as when he found himself before Sirwa, or Kayudas. His cheeks literally prickled. And yet, at the same time, he never felt so unworthy of the mother's dread design. To stand before the Anasarimba was to doubt. Things old.
"The Nonmen have invoked Nyam," she said, "an ancient ritual."
Something in her tone seized his attention. She had sounded almost embarrassed.
"I don't understand."
Her gaze had recovered its remote vantage. She considered him with a serenity that he yearned to muddy with his passion.
"Evil. How could someone so beautiful be evil?"
"The ancient Nonmen kings found men too mercurial," she explained, "too proud and headstrong to be trusted. So in all their dealings they demanded hostages as a guarantee, a son, a daughter, and a captive enemy, two former as surety against treachery, the latter as a surety against deception."
The sun broke behind her, light unfurled in a burning fan about her silhouette.
"And I am to play the enemy," he said, holding a hand out against her glare.
What new twist was this?
"Yes,"
her shadow replied against the high drone of the interval. He had expected her to vanish, to wink out of existence the same way she had winked in. But she simply turned and began walking at an angle into the eastern sun.
Her shadow floated across the trampled earth, drawn as long and slender as a felled sapling. With every step she became smaller, a mere wisp before the enormity of dawn. Ever more lonely and afraid.